This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome, everyone, to the New Books Network. I'm your host today, Renee Garris, and I'm delighted to have as our guest Professor Julie Pfeiffer. She is a professor of English at Hollins University and published Transforming Girls, the work of 19th century adolescents with the University of Mississippi Press in 2021. Julie, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you, Renee. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Thank you. So why don't you start by telling our audience a little bit about yourself and your career?
Yeah, so I grew up in Connecticut as the eldest of three girls in what was very much a family of women. I was given girls' books to read. Sort of some of my earliest memories are the books that my mother and my grandmother and my aunt gave me, books that they had loved as children. And so I always had this experience of loving to read, loving, you know, losing myself in imagined worlds. And I certainly didn't only read girls' books. I read everything I could get my hands on. I think the other thing that had a real influence on my career was my father was a scientist. And so twice in my childhood, we went and lived in other places. I lived in Paris for a year and in Germany for a year. And that really developed my love of languages and my interest in the ways that culture shapes literature, shapes identities. So when I went to college, I went to Carleton College in Minnesota, which was a wonderful place for me, and had this interdisciplinary major in philosophy and comparative literature. And I really, I loved making connections. I realized that that was the thing I really cared about. I also loved college and thought, well, what do I need to do so that I never have to really graduate? And decided I would go to graduate school and that I hoped to be a professor. So I went to graduate school at the University of Connecticut and got a PhD in English literature. And then at UConn, started taking classes in children's literature. It wasn't something when I initially decided to go to graduate school, I wasn't necessarily thinking I was going to specialize in children's literature. But the University of Connecticut had this wonderful program, lots of faculty who are working in this area, and the journal Children's Literature, which I ended up working on as a graduate student and now have edited for almost 20 years. So I wrote a dissertation on Milton and Charlotte Bronte. I still, you know, had children's literature a little bit on a back burner, something I really liked, but I didn't see it as the focus. And then I got hired at Hollins University, where I still teach. and started teaching children's literature. And as I taught it, I got really interested in girls' books in particular, and started thinking more about my own experience as a reader of girls' books and now as a teacher of girls' books. So I've been at Hollins for 25 years now. I'm chair of the Department of English and Creative Writing. Have had a really wonderful career there, and I'm grateful to be at a place that supports my writing and my teaching and my commitment to the liberal arts.
Absolutely. And you mentioned connections, and I think connections is something that is really evident in this book. How did you come specifically to write this book? What was the impetus for this subject?
Yeah, thanks. In its original version, this was a book that I was going to call something like Why We Love Gender. So the question that was kind of haunting me is, as I was trained as a feminist scholar and then was teaching students using feminist theory and gender theory, I kept trying to figure out why it was that I still loved these girls' books that I'd read as a child, even though in a way I felt like I ought to know better. So that was the original project, was some sort of book called Why We Love Gender, what it was that gender, you know, seeing the gender patterns that are maybe familiar from our childhood, why that might feel satisfying and comforting. Before I had really fleshed out what that book was going to look like, I got a Fulbright senior scholar grant to go work at the Institute for Children's Literature Research in Frankfurt, Germany. And so I took my three kids and went to Frankfurt. And there I was really mentored by colleagues who said, gosh, you know, we know you know a lot about American girls' books, but we think you also need to read German girls' books. So I started reading 19th century German girls' books that I had never heard of. For the most part, they were completely unfamiliar to me, even though these were books that were tremendously popular in Germany. They, you know, books that had the same status in Germany that a book like Little Women has in the US. So, you know, after spending this time in Germany and reading these books, I got really curious about the ways that American and German girls' books were alike and not alike, and decided that that was really the thing I wanted to focus on in this book. And so gender remains part of this project, absolutely, but it's now in the context of thinking about this cross-cultural exchange between the U.S. and Germany around adolescence in the 19th century.
Well, as our readers will learn through your introduction, you have a very detailed background sort of as you came to this project. And many of the books that you mentioned from the English side certainly remind me of summers spent reading. And I like what you said. Some of the books that we probably shouldn't like, but we still do, like as gender scholars, why? So I found that really important. And for our listeners, the introduction to this book is fantastic, and it's quite detailed. And one of the questions that I have for Professor Pfeiffer is that she discusses gender binaries and gender fluidity. And there's a paradox in that, in this telling of setting up the stories of the Backfisch. So if you would like to introduce our readers to that concept.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Backfisch is the German word for an adolescent girl. And what I learned in Germany was that there was this whole genre of girls' books that were focused around adolescent girls. And this was surprising to me because I had been taught and had assumed with other critics that 19th century American girls' books were either orphan girl stories or family stories. So there are other books like Little Women, that are centered around a whole family and multiple protagonists, or they were books like Anne of Green Gables or A Little Princess that focus on an orphan girl who is kind of without resources in the world and has to make a home for herself. So instead, it turns out there are these books written in both Germany and the US. There are these novels written for and about adolescent girls. And these novels frame this period of adolescence as a time of transition. So partly, I think what you're asking about here, Renee, is this paradox that on the one hand, these books for adolescent girls appear to be very socially conservative. So they rely on gender binaries. They assume that the most important thing about men and women, girls and boys, is that they are opposite from each other. These novels are definitely set within a patriarchal world, a world that assumes whiteness as the norm. So there are all kinds of reasons why we might think, yeah, these probably aren't books that are going to be particularly useful to us in a world where we're trying to move away from sexist and racist perspectives. But what I found in reading these books is that the social conservatism is accompanied by this focus on girlhood and this acceptance of girlhood as a fluid, flexible space, and that, you know, that there's this ability, you know, I find myself quoting Walt Whitman a lot these days, this idea of we can contain multitudes. And it seems to me that these books contain multitudes. They are socially conservative and they are liberatory all at the same time. And that's what I wanted to better understand. And what I think actually ultimately helps me answer this question of, you know, well, why do we love these books that are conservative in some ways, but also imagine girlhood as a space of change and exploration, where it's okay to make mistakes, where adults have the responsibility to provide mentoring for girls. It feels to me like in the world of the 19th century girls' books, there's actually a much more accepting, there's a gentler perspective towards adolescent girlhood than we may see sometimes today.
Absolutely. And perhaps we should set up for our listeners, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but as we're sort of looking at the difference between what it is to become a girl and a woman in the United States, and again, this is 19th century, versus this in Germany, that this adolescence period really in German literature, and perhaps if you could answer in Germany itself, did allow for, yet like you said, like girls making mistakes, they could be obedient and delinquent without rejecting the adults. But perhaps say something a little bit, or can you say something more about that, about how it was different for young American girls and young German girls and how this was reflected in the literature?
Right, right. So I actually, one of the surprises of this project for me was I had assumed that the American books were going to be focused on girlhood and the German books I'd learned were focused on adolescence. But it turned out that there is this group of 19th century books that are about adolescent girls and that imagine adolescence in a very similar way to this German model. So both the German and the American adolescent girls were being, maybe a way to think about this is that these are novels that focus on this small, short period of time in the girl's life, this period of transition. And in this space of transition, these girls are really seen, they're certainly not idealized in the way that sometimes the girls of like the orphan girl novel, you know, Anne of Green Gables is really idealized in many ways. The girls in these books are messier, they're more awkward. They definitely have things to learn from their community. And there's a sense that their community is able to meet their needs. So I think the difference here that became increasingly clear to me is that in the 20th and 21st century, adolescence is really imagined as this time of alienation and angst. Stanley Hall called it Sturm und Drang, storm and stress. So adolescence is seen as this particularly difficult time. And in contrast, in the model of the Bachfisch, which I discovered through the example of these German books, but also shows up in the American books, adolescence is maybe difficult for the girl as she's working really hard to figure out how to become a woman. But it isn't necessarily difficult for her community, that her community can feel kind of relaxed and loving and capable in a way that I think many 20th and 21st century parents feel a lot of anxiety about whether they can successfully engage with their adolescent daughters.
Sure. I think one of the sentences you, and I'm taking this out of context, but it said, let girls explore rather than force them into maturation. So they were allowed to be normal or typical of their age.
Yeah. 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 And that's a great way to put it. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. I'd like to discuss for a moment the premise of education for the readers. And I had this as one of our questions because education helps shape identity. And in part of your introduction, you have that this shaping of identity and this premise of education can sometimes lead to lasting happiness. This was one of the moral lessons. Is there something more you would like to say about that?
Yeah. Thanks, Renee. So, you know, I'll maybe take a little bit of a step back. So one of the things that I think is important to understand about the idea of the Bachfisch is that it is coming out of a model in Germany where girls typically left school around 14, but they weren't seen as being old enough to get married until 18 or 19. So there's this interim period where they're finished with formal education, and yet they need to be kept busy in some way, right? There's some risk for their families. They can't, you know, be left to just hang out on street corners. They've got to have something to do to fill their time. And the education that these girls receive in this period between 14 and 18 is often not, it can be in a school. Sometimes the girl is sent away to a boarding school, sort of a finishing school. That's one option. But more often she's sent away to an aunt or another adult woman who kind of takes her in as a project and educates her in both the emotional and domestic labor of becoming a woman. So it's fascinating to me in these books, there's often this very detailed description of like how to serve tea or how to dust properly. You know, this sense that domestic labor is really central to the work of becoming a woman. But then there's also this instruction in emotional labor, the work of when to display your emotions, when to hide your emotions, that, you know, you shouldn't, if you meet a friend on the street, you shouldn't be too exuberant in your greeting of her, that will make people think that you're not quite proper. It may make men think that you're available for flirtation when you're really not. So there are all of these these guidelines, these lessons that these girls are learning from adult women, whether it's a teacher at a boarding school or an aunt. But absolutely, this idea of lasting happiness is key here, because often there are examples of women who didn't get a good education in their teenage years. So, for example, in Gretchen's Joys and Sorrows, Backfischen's Leiden und Freuden, which is the kind of paradigmatic German Backfisch book, Gretchen's cousin comes to stay with them because her mother is really not capable of taking good care of her. And there's a line, I probably can't quote it exactly, but something like, you know, Gretchen learns how lucky she is to be receiving the education of this aunt, because it's a pernicious thing not to be educated properly. And it has consequences, not just for the girl, the girl herself, but then also if a woman hasn't been educated properly, she won't be able to raise her own daughters well. So lasting happiness really requires that in this essential period of adolescence, a girl learns the right lessons.
I find this really intriguing as we think about the cultural bonds that this literature brought. And in chapter 3, which is converting girls into women, you specifically use a gender theory as a lens to help see the transformation. Would you say that this is definitely in the Protestant cultural norm, or?
Yeah. What a great question. And that's something that I sort of note in this book, but I don't go into a lot of detail. That yes, so these are books that are in both the U.S. and Germany. They are books that assume a white Protestant and even Northern audience. So in Germany, these books tend to be written by Prussian authors and published in Prussia. In the US, they tend to be written in New England or maybe the Midwest. And you know, that's seen as the kind of cultural site. And then as you say, in both of these cases, it is a Protestant audience that's assumed. Catholicism, where it comes up, is definitely othered. It's seen as something kind of foreign. There's a character in one of these books, Faith Gartney's Girlhood. There's a character named Glory, who's an orphan, who was born to a Catholic family and still has a sort of Catholic identity. But when Glory is welcomed into the home of a single woman who proceeds to educate her and kind of help her have a Backfisch period, she becomes a Protestant. You know, she still has some of her old Catholic, I think she has a rosary she inherited from her mother that she treasures, but she definitely aligns herself with Protestant culture and religion as the novel progresses. So you're right. This is definitely a part of what's happening here and not something that I necessarily have figured out exactly why this is the case, but you're right that it's a kind of subculture even within the cultures of these, you know, large, diverse countries. There are lots of different cultural perspectives, and these books are really focused in this Northern Protestant community.
Right. Something I should have asked earlier, and so I'd like to jump in right now. How many books were translated from German into English, and then versus the English going into German? How much of a cultural exchange in that regard with translation happened?
Yeah, well, so when I started trying to sort out this project and how it was going to work. I had long, long lists of books that I thought, yep, this, you know, this fits the model of the Bachfisch book. But then I thought, you know, I really want to be talking about not just these examples of books about adolescent girls, but I want to be thinking about this as a kind of cross-cultural exchange. So I ended up selecting books to focus on in my book that were translated. So the eight books that I talk about, the eight novels I talk about in my book, were all translated. Sometimes very soon after publication, sometimes much later. But I did want somehow to get at this sense that these were books that were of interest to both German speaking and English speaking, or English reading, German reading, a German reading audience.
Yes, because we have to assume some, that we understand the migratory patterns, how many Germans were coming into the north part of the United States and back.
Another piece of this, right? So it seems sort of obvious, like we know that there was a huge German language speaking population in the U.S. in the 19th century, and that there were schools that where instruction was entirely in German, and you know, and this is, and I think it's something we've kind of forgotten because after World War I, there was a real switch, and it became kind of taboo to have a German language school. But before then, you know, there's this huge German speaking population in the U.S. The interest in Germany is a little different. So the interest in English language books in Germany isn't because there's an immigrant population, English speaking immigrant population, but it's because American literature was beginning to be seen as a literature, you know, that, you know, I think we sometimes forget that for a long time you didn't study, if you were studying English literature in school in the 19th century, you mostly read British literature. You didn't read American literature because there wasn't a sense that America had a literature worth studying. But that changes in the 19th century, and it changes not just for Americans, it also changes for Europeans. And so it starts to be a sense that it is important to learn English, that reading books in English is valuable. And so American novels start being published both in English and being translated into Germany, especially starting around the 1870s. I think it also speaks to the ways that German or American children's book authors were writing these really dynamic, exciting books that were also really popular in translation in Germany. So Louisa May Alcott's work in particular was being translated and widely read. I feel like there was one more thing I wanted to say about that. Yeah, but so just to reiterate, this is really an exchange that's happening. Oh, I know. The other thing I wanted to say that I think is relevant here is that there aren't copyright laws that are protecting the work of authors at this point. And so one reason to take a German book and translate it into English and publish it in the US is that you don't have to pay the author royalties. And the same thing in Germany, you can just pick up a copy of Louisa May Alcott's Little Women, find a translator, maybe pay the translator, but you don't pay Alcott. So it's a way to come up with material without having to pay an author royalties.
Sure. So we've mentioned that the Bachfisch time period is really this adolescence between girlhood and adult womanhood. But what is the arc of the age of the readers?
Yeah, well, so, you know, of course, we can't know for sure who was reading these books. The other, you know, one of my criteria in choosing novels to write about in my book was that they had been published in both English and German. And that was in part because I was interested in translation issues and I wanted to see how these stories were presented in different languages. But the other criteria I had was that I wanted to publish books that were bestsellers, which is kind of a tricky term in the 19th century. You know, there is no New York Times list of best-selling books to refer to, but there are some lists of books that went through large print runs. There's research that's been done about books that were checked out from libraries, which books were checked out most often from libraries. So I was looking at that material. I would say that, so while I can't say who actually was reading these books, and my guess is it was probably girls from, you know, 8 or 9 or 10 through adult women, in the same way that I think, you know, girls' books today still get read by girls and women and men of all ages. They're addressed in general to adolescent girls. And that is one of the key elements of these novels, is that they are seen as providing a form of mentorship and community for adolescent girls. So in Gretchen's Joys and Sorrows, for example, the narrator starts out by saying, you know, I know that the Bachfisch period adolescence can be a difficult time, and I hope that this book will comfort you in, you know, in your experience of adolescence. So that is the explicit audience for these novels.
Nice. I know personally, going back reading material that I read as an adolescent when my daughter was in her adolescence. Mm-hmm. I don't know, Little House on the Prairie. I found myself rolling my eyes all the time. Like, why did I think this was so great?
And, right.
But I mean, that is part of the aging process. Although I still really do enjoy going back and reading books from many years ago, because I get something different as an adult than I did as an adolescent. So,
mm-hmm. Yes. Well, and I think it's also fun to be reading, you know, rereading them with a daughter. I'm curious, you know, what were some of your daughter's favorite books?
So she went through a period. She loved Greek goddesses, which is something that's published. There's a series for young girls that takes the feminine perspective of female Greek goddesses and puts them in roles of power rather than it being a male-dominated canon of gods. And she loved those. And then, of course, she loved all the Harry Potters. And then she moved into teen angst, like so many other 13, 14-year-old girls do, The Fault in Our Stars, that type of series, yes. And then, of course, at 16, she became an adult. She became of age, I would like to say, and moved on to reading more adult books. And so now she's in college and she'll say, oh, mom, do you have this book? And I'm like, hold on, let me go through my shelves. Yeah, here, you don't have to buy it. So, so it has been nice watching her grow up. But the things that I loved, like Nancy Drew, she had no desire to read.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting. Yeah, I've seen a real shift. You know, I teach this class called American Girls Fiction, and I've taught it for probably 20 years now. And I've definitely seen a switch. And Nancy Drew is one example. I would say 20 years ago, most of the students in my class had read Nancy Drew. They were passionate about Nancy Drew. They really wanted to talk about Nancy Drew. And now I actually have taken Nancy Drew off the syllabus, because it feels like in the last 5 or 10 years, somehow Nancy Drew is no longer part of the reading experience of most adolescent girls. So it is interesting how these things shift. I'm not aware of that series about the Greek goddesses. That sounds fantastic.
I will look up the actual author and series and send it to you. So what I'm talking about. Yeah. But so that sort of leads me actually to a bit of off topic. So do you think that your students today, your college students, when they were adolescents, did they read a cross-section of male and female writers and male and female experiences? Were they looking for their same gender experience or?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, So a couple of things. One is that I think girls are typically, it's assumed that girls will read anything. So girls get given, and I think there's still an assumption that boys will not read books about girls. And so in schools, most books need to be about boys so that the boys will read them, but the girls will read whatever you give them. So that's, you know, they'll be fine with it. And I think for many of my students, so I teach at a women's college, and I think one of the things that really delights many of my students is that we really can center the experience of women and girls. And so many of my classes will have a syllabus of books that are all by women, all about female protagonists. Certainly not all of my classes, but some of them are focused in that way. The other thing that I think is has shifted and that is really important for my students today is recognizing the ways that the category of girlhood or womanhood is much more fluid than my students even 10 years ago would have, or maybe even 5 years ago would have said. And so, you know, part of the conversation we have these days is about, you know, what does it even mean to define yourself as male or female or neither? Is a book about a trans boy, you know, how does a book like that fit into the history and the tradition of the girls' book? Like when we open up the story to say, well, sometimes a girl's book ends not with a woman, but with a man, you know, and that's also part of the history of the girl's book, the contemporary history of the girl's book. And I, you know, so those are some of the things that we're talking about in my class right now. And it's just been a real pleasure for me as somebody who's interested in gender theory, who, you know, I spent a lot of time in the early part of my career talking about, okay, why do we find it so important to have there be this difference between male and female? Like, why do we keep having, you know, different colors for girls and boys and different attributes for girls and boys? Like, what happens if we let go of some of that? And so it's been really fun for me to see my students be really engaged in the ways that gender doesn't always have to be about difference. It can be about an individual's own experience. It can be about a protagonist story that isn't limited to, you know, girls always grow up to be women.
What a powerful statement. I love what you said about your students. It makes me wish I could go back to being a young reader again and not have a predestined outcome, that I knew that Nancy Drew was going to be a woman sort of thing. So,
Exactly. And Nancy Drew is such a great example of that very restrained or constrained version of femininity. You know, Nancy Drew is already the perfect young woman at the beginning of the series. She doesn't need to change or really learn anything. She is already like perfectly groomed. She's perfectly dressed. She knows how to engage socially in ways that both like assert her femininity and her intelligence and ability to solve crimes. Like, but she's able to like be competent and feminine at the same time. She doesn't ever get in trouble in that way. And so there is something, you know, Nancy Drew is the example of, it's kind of the opposite of the Bachfisch book, because Nancy is perfect when the series begins and she remains perfect. Whereas the Bachfisch is absolutely not perfect when her story begins. Like, she has a lot to figure out. And it's really, the story is about the figuring out. And I think the power in that for readers, both adolescent readers and adult readers, is it says, you know what, it's okay to sometimes not do things in a way that gets you the approval of people around you. Like, it's okay to make mistakes. It's okay to try on different identities and see if they work for you or not. And that, you know, I think in our culture, we sort of label that adolescence and kind of put it in that space in our lives. But the reality is, I think we all have days where we're feeling awkward and uncomfortable and trying to figure out who we actually are and who we want to be. It's not something that's just limited to adolescence.
Absolutely. Even, yes, as an adult, as a mother, yes, I'm lucky to know where I am some days. That brings me to the different types of Bachfisch, the tropes, if you will. So you've mentioned that you have the story of the of an orphan. Are there some other well-used tropes or character lines that you found with the Bachfisch?
Yeah. So the distinction that I write about and that I am finding really useful in my teaching and my research is to think about three different categories of girls' stories. So one of those categories is the Bachfisch novel, and that is the story about the adolescent girl in this time of transition. Another type of girl's book is the orphan girl novel, and there's been some great research done on that genre. Joe Sutliff Sanders has a book called Disciplining Girls that is really useful for talking about the ways that the orphan girl book develops in the 19th century into the 20th century. And that's a model that rises out of the sentimental novel for adults. And then the third category is the family story. So I think I mentioned before books like Little Women, Five Little Peppers and How They Grew. That was a series that I loved as a kid. Many of Alcott's books are family stories. And those are stories where there's often more than one protagonist. You have this, you know, in Little Women, for example, you have this whole family of girls and their mother, and it's really a story about all four of the girls. The thing that the Bachfisch book does that I find so fascinating is that in the family story, the girl is secure, but she's also somewhat limited. So being at home provides safety, but it also means that her growth is happening very much in the context of her family of origin. In the orphan girl novel, the orphan girl has to leave home because she doesn't have a home anymore, and she has to create a life for herself somewhere else. So there's this sense of adventure. But she's at risk, you know, and the novels sometimes downplay the risk a little bit. You know, these aren't terrifying novels, but there is a kind of trauma that lies not very far underneath the surface, that these are girls who are unprotected. And if, you know, if they don't behave themselves, if they don't convince adults to love them, they can be in significant danger. So the Bachfisch book takes the safety of the family story and the adventure of the orphan girl book and puts them together. So it's a model that has things in common with both of the other types of girls' books, but is kind of unique in this sense of, you know, a girl who is confident that she is loved. She has a loving family at home. She's not leaving home because there's been some tragedy. She's leaving home because her parents think it's worth investing in her growth and education and sending her off to the city or to a boarding school, but to somebody who will have the time to really devote to her growth. So I really I love the family stories and the orphan girl stories too, but I think there's something really powerful in this Bachfisch model where a girl gets to both be loved and leave home. She doesn't have to do one or the other.
Again, something very powerful that we could use today. I would like to read from your conclusion. I'm on page 165 if you happen to have a book in front of you, but this is I think, one of the most beautiful paragraphs of any concluding book that I've read, so I wanted to read it to our audience. The Bachfisch, the adolescent girl who paved the way for later literary heroines, opens a window into early structures for mentoring and protecting adolescent girls. Bachfisch books, the earliest novels for girls to focus on female adolescence, challenge our cultural assumptions about progress, about adolescence, and about what it was like to be a girl in the 19th century. In particular, by imagining girls as powerful actors and adolescence as creative space, they complicate a belief that girls' books always evolve towards less sexist and restrictive images of girls. I found this paragraph just like it. First of all, it did a beautiful job in wrapping up your book, but it really spoke to literature today, literature of the 19th century, literature of the 20th century. Do you have any other comments you would like to add to that beautiful conclusion?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Renee. I appreciate the compliment, and it was lovely to hear you read that paragraph. I think that this speaks to a couple of things that are near and dear to me. So one is the question of what the 19th century has to offer us today. And I think that, you know, I'm not the only one who's thinking about this. I've been really fascinated by recent shows like Apple TV's Dickinson or the Enola Holmes Netflix series, the new film version of Little Women. Like, there's a way that culturally, I think we are really intrigued by the 19th century. We're curious about what we might learn from the 19th century. And what I would suggest is that part of what we may learn is that even though the 19th century is linked to all kinds of repression for women, for people of color, for disabled people, there are also ideas, there are ways of thinking about community, about thinking about nurturing each other that are still valuable for us today. So that we can look back to the 19th century. And absolutely, we can critique it. We can think about the kinds of progress that we've made. But it doesn't have to be an either or. We can say, no, we don't want to do everything the way that it was done in the 19th century. But there's some pieces that we might want to return to, that we might want to hold on to. And one of these pieces is a model for honoring adolescence, so kind of treasuring it, not just seeing it as something to be endured, as this like horrible thing that you just have to do and you hope it's over as soon as possible. So honoring adolescence, and also as adults, taking on the responsibility for nurturing adolescence in ways that allow them to relax a little bit. So those are some of the things that I took away from this project and I'm still enjoying thinking about.
Absolutely. Adolescence, we do, and you mentioned this in the introduction and several times, adolescence, we make it into something that's full of angst when it doesn't have to be. There is a better way, so to speak. So, yes. So I've taken up a lot of your time, but what are some of your next projects? What else do you have in the pipeline, so to speak?
Yeah, thanks. So I'm working on an article with a close colleague, Professor Darla Shum, who's professor of religious studies at Hollins University. We're finishing up an article right now about silence in girls' books, and in particular, the idea that when girls become quiet, and we're looking at two 19th century novels, Heidi and What Katie Did, and an early 20th century novel, Anne of Green Gables, that some critics have argued that in books like these, when girls become quiet, it's a mark of constraint, that their kind of violence is being enacted on them that is denying them their voice. And we're looking at disability studies and religious studies to think about the ways that silence in these books is also a form of empowerment, that these girls may choose to not speak as much, but because as readers we have access to their internal experience, we can see that they're actually taking on a kind of power. So Anne of Green Gables has this great line where she says to Marilla, you know, I used to want to use big words and I talked all the time, but now I've realized that I'd rather keep some of my thoughts, I'd rather keep them, kind of treasure them inside and not share them. And part of what we think is going on there is that when the girl shares what she thinks, she makes her speech subject to discipline. Other people can tell her she's right or wrong and you know, what she should say or shouldn't say. When she takes on this sense of treasuring her thoughts internally, she's also taking on a kind of authority to judge for herself what she wants to think, what, you know, what ideas she has. And so there, it seems to us that there's a kind of power in that. So that's one project I'm working on. Another project that I'm is in really beginning stages, but I'm very interested in. One of the things that became clear to me in working on this book, Transforming Girls, was the ways that that whiteness is seen as, you know, it's this kind of hidden marker of virtue in these novels. There's a lot of discussion of soap and water, especially in the German Bockfisch books. It's really, you know, these girls learn how to scrub their fingernails and wash their faces properly. And so there's this sense that being clean is really important. And so on the surface, this is just about being clean, but it seems to me it's also about marking the ways these girls are seen as good girls is in part that they are different from girls of color. And I'm curious then to think about, so how do the stories of girls of color in the 19th century, how do they fit if they are being, I think, sort of deliberately excluded from these Bockfisch narratives? Where do the stories of girls of color fit into the history of the girls' book? And so the thing that I'm wondering about is, and I'm about to teach a class on this next week, so I may have figured out more then, but I'm looking at Harriet Jacobs' Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl and Burnett's A Little Princess, and thinking about the ways that the garret functions in both of these stories. And so, you know, Linda Brent in Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl spends several years in a garret space so that she can be near her children, but, you know, protected from the man who owns her. And Sarah Crewe in A Little Princess spends a shorter period of time in an attic. And I'm just trying to figure out the ways that A Little Princess might be borrowing from that fugitive narrative that Jacobs writes, and thinking about the attic as a space that, you know, marks you as other, but might also be protective. So that's a new project, but one that I've been, having fun thinking about.
Well, they both sound fascinating, and I would love to have you back when you get the material done. I mean, both, I could speak volumes about quiet versus silence and the power of white over looking at white being good, not white, not good. So, but we will save those conversations for our next meeting. So, Professor Pfeiffer, thank you so much for spending your afternoon with me. And I look forward to hearing from you again soon.
Thank you, Renee. This was a real pleasure. I appreciate the chance to speak with you.